Welcome back to the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast. Today we're honored to be joined by Natalie Rosott, MIES. She is the founder of Foscope, a think tank on light. She is a New York-based photo tech and the recipient of many prestigious awards, grants, fellowships, and sponsorships, including a 2021 WIL Award for the Global Solar Lighting Initiative, LightReach. She has a strong track record of contributions to social and critical issues in lighting and to the lighting and design education areas. These include international keynote presentations, speaking engagements, and publications, as well as a part-time professorship at the New School, former engagements as senior thesis faculty in lighting design master's programs, senior guest lecturer in landscape architect master's programs in Versailles and Lille, and education columnist for the IES's publication, LDNA. Foscope.org, lightreach.net, and then social media will be listed on the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast. But before we do, we have to get a grip on something else, Greg Garrett, Grip Lock Systems. Go to GRPLOCKSYSTEMS.com. I did it.
You kind of did it. I told you not to spell it because you missed the I between the R. It's the P, but that's okay. Grip Lock. But hey, from the ceiling down to the fixture, they provide everything you need to suspend your light fixture. The key component is a unique self-locking, completely adjustable device that can lock onto a long range of aircraft cables and no tools. You can adjust it up and down as often as you'd like. Labor-saving installation, they have in-house engineers, and they check every product they send out, safety and quality control, made right here, Grip Lock Systems. No chains.
Go to GripLockSystems.com, folks, and of course, the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors. Is this podcast going to be out before the convention, Greg?
Oh, it's going to be tight.
Tight.
Scott question. I think it might be.
Okay, well, we're going to be in Dallas, 17th through 19th, something like that, September, coming up quick. Ooh, that came up fast. Be there or be square. Natalie, welcome to the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I think the first question I have changed when Mike read the bio on you. What is a photo tech? Mm-hmm.
It's a profession of one at the moment. The idea is that if somebody tells me I'm an architect, I can say I'm a photo tech. And that was, that was the beginning of Foscope. Reclaiming the Greek roots of light, photo. When you say photo, everybody thinks photography. And I think that we are really missing out in our industry because that should be our root. So I really thought that to speak about phototecture as opposed to lighting design, which I've always thought was kind of a weak term, really sets the tone. So it became as a, again, that was at the beginning of Foscope, and that word, led to a whole lexicon, which people can find on the website if they're interested. But I was really hoping it would actually catch up more than it did, because I think that it's should be an attractive term to more than me.
Yeah,
why
you know,
is lighting...
Hang on, I just want to get into this a little bit. Everyone and no one is a lighting designer. I mean, there is the IALD, and I respect their practice and their certifications and that sort of stuff. But like a lighting, you're right, the lighting design term is thrown around a lot. And it's kind of to the point of, where it's difficult to know what actually a lighting designer is. And really an interior designer, really their primary thing is light. If they're doing interior design, they need light, right? So I found it to be an awkward term as well. And it's interesting that you've changed how you refer to yourself to photo tech. So I find that fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I think also, if I may just add, Foscope was born out of a reaction against a very architecture-centric world. And I really wanted to take a photocentric position. Let's look at the design world. Let's look at environments from a lighting standpoint. And I thought that you cannot do that from you know, if you're called a lighting designer. So I thought phototexture really established the position a lot better.
Yeah, and I guess that was going to be my question, is why you felt it's a weak term, but I think you kind of answered there. I mean, do you feel like the term should be changed? Make that stance right now?
Oh, absolutely. I've thought that the term should be changed like over 10 years ago.
Why hasn't it caught on?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. Hmm. It caught on with me, so I'm the wrong person to ask.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, how did you get into lighting?
I guess by accident, in a way. I had been trained as a designer, worked in, actually as an interior designer, but that's pretty much the only field in which I never practiced. I worked in architecture, landscape architecture, urban planning, product design, exhibit design, both in Paris and in New York. And I ended up working, I at some point I was doing some freelance work, and I had a client who needed somebody to do renderings, and turned out to be a lighting design company in New York. So I actually got into lighting design through drawing, and I really fell in love with it because, I mean, first of all, I think it's a very beautiful way to get into the field, because I had to understand the technical aspects from the effects that I was drawing. And that's something that I've always, throughout my teachings afterwards, that's something that I've always kept as a good process to learn lighting. And, you know, I realized pretty quickly that it was, lighting was about design, it's about technology, it's about science. And I was never somebody who needed to build concrete, you know, projects in concrete. So in many ways, it was sort of the perfect, I felt it was the perfect match. And then it, because it was also relatively underdeveloped discipline, in the sense that it's a young discipline, I felt that it also offered a lot of opportunities for theoretical explorations. So it's... I started around 2000, and I never left.
Mm. You know, one of the things that when I was doing my research for this phototech, when I was doing the research for the show, Greg, is I noticed that the Photoscope website uses much different terminology. I'm going to read a sentence or two from their mission statement. I'm going to ask Natalie to comment on it, okay? So complex lighting ecologies, that's something I've never heard before, a lighting ecology, are integral to the cultural history of our varying and evolving constructed environments, forms, and functions. Yet, issues of light and lighting have been co-opted, Greg Eric, to date. They've been co-opted by energy requirements, architectural practices, and marketing strategies, and reduced to performance, technology, and luminaires. I think that is so true, Natalie. Explain to me, like, it's almost like I feel like the lighting industry is being abused by utilities or energy efficiency programs as a way to, the only place that they can actually get mitigation. It's like, oh, we need to reduce our energy consumption. Do more lighting, right? To make lighting more energy efficient. And they can't get any action anywhere else. And so they keep coming to lighting to reduce its energy consumption. I think we've carried that torch for 25 years now or longer, maybe 40 years. I couldn't agree with you more. Tell me about how that mission statement and how you guys decided to use those kinds of terms and how did it get co-opted? There's a bunch of questions in that.
Well, I think it gets co-opted. you're making me question the wording of the mission statement. You know, I just think it doesn't stand strongly enough by itself. And I go back to, you know, the phototexture statement. If you, lighting is very, I mean, in many lighting designers will keep saying, well, there's architecture first. We serve architecture. We serve landscape architecture. And I actually really questioned that. You may be half convinced already because you're saying there's no interior design without lighting design. And in many ways that applies to, you know, color selections and texture selections mm-hmm. and finish selections and so forth and so on. So why not expand this further and really make turn lighting in a standalone, you know, equal field of design. I've worked in numerous large-scale projects where they were probably up to 10 consultants, architecture, landscape architecture, urban ecology, you know. There is always an assumption that the lead of those projects is going to be a landscape architect or an architect. I think it's very conceivable that we could be in a world where the lead is the phototext, because of everything that that entails in terms of the design and so forth and so on. And when you take that standpoint, then you're not just looking at efficiency issues. You're not the reduced by the other domains to, well, you have to light that space and you have to comply with energy requirements and you have to comply with, which I think we are all you know, far too ready to agree with. And you know, we are not fighting that enough. One of the things that, as you may have seen as well, I'm going around here, but without answering directly your question, maybe I find it's a better way to actually answer it. I work with solar lighting quite a bit. Solar lighting, outdoor solar lighting is off-grid. That's the main quality of solar lighting, because in many ways the energy efficiency is not all that important if you're looking at low energy or low consumption sources, right? On the other hand, if you look at wired lighting, imagine that a few years from now we have energy efficiency is not an issue. Let's imagine a world where we have affordable, highly efficient, renewable energy. Mm-hmm. What does it do to our whole focus and obsession with energy efficient lighting? Do we need that in order to justify, you know, going back or not giving up conventional sources like incandescent and so forth and so on? I think that we are just being pushed. But we are willingly doing that as a whole profession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're being bossed around by other people's priorities. And I couldn't agree with you more. The other thing is, you made a point there about energy. I think we need clean, abundant, cheap, as much electricity as we want to use, and clean and cheap. Like, we should have as much as we want to use. This poverty mindset that's captured, almost every area of lighting, that we have to energy efficiency, lower, reduce energy consumption. I would like to see the utilities come back and say, actually, we built these wonderful plants here and the energy is cheap and you can use as much of it as you want. I don't understand the poverty mindset that's entered the lighting industry. I think we need to adopt an abundance mindset, maybe as a society, that the universe has everything we need, and we can achieve it by technological innovation. But I think it starts with, to me, everything starts with clean energy. Natalie, did we lose you? Are you there?
No, I'm listening. I agree. But I think that I'm not saying that if we don't have that's, you know, cheap, clean energy available right now, that it's not a good idea to be economical with how we use lighting or how we use energy, rather, and electricity. But I think that the, in many ways, I mean, that's what the training is by design, and that's what we should always claim. Lighting experts, not to say, you know, lighting designers, should work with the minimum, always. Only use what you need to in order to get what you want to achieve. So I think that it's, you know, we are, as a profession in the design field, there's an imposition from other fields. And in terms of, you know, absolute savings, possibly, all those measures and policies to save energy, but I always like to look at the relative. What about, you know, other building systems? What about other urban systems? How do we compare to that, given the return on investment that, you know, good lighting brings to people and spaces?
Yeah. So on your Foscope, we've talked about here, you establish it to facilitate change in the practice, education, and critical study of lighting. Why is change needed? I know we've talked a little bit. Why specifically? What was the moment where you said, I need to do this because we're doing it all wrong?
I mean, it's, just to continue on what we were talking about, I think that the practice of light right now is very much, or the design practice of light is very much done within the world of architectural design, and I think that we could we can earn a stronger position in the constructed environment. You know, our discipline is also, I mean, again, it's a young discipline. It's very practice oriented. It's very commercial and technology driven. And it doesn't have a whole lot of critical study under its belt. So I go back to, I think there are a lot of opportunities to do that. And it's a fact that it will help us establish a stronger discipline if we have a stronger critical discourse in it. I have zero doubt about that.
What is a critical discourse? Explain that to me exactly. I see that here in your bio, critical issues and social. Explain what a critical discourse is.
Critical discourse is, you basically question. You question everything. You question, you look at, I mean, it's analysis and of current practices, current technologies. You look at the history of it. You look at the social implication of common practices, and you put them in a, you know, you can put them in a different context, or you compare them with, I go back to the absolute versus relative. Very often we think of lighting in terms of absolute, but then if you're looking at certain lighting issues in the context of other issues, that really opens up new ways of thinking about it and looking at it differently. I'm very tempted, as much as I think that I may be opening Pandora's box here, because I know that you're fervent followers of and of dark skies. I apply that to light pollution as well. I really think that we need to put light pollution as a theme, as a topic, as a very complex one, within the larger context of environmental pollution. It's because right now we are, I hear a lot of discussion and a lot of very passionate advocacy for dark sky and against light pollution. that is much more emotionally driven than data driven. Mm-hmm. And we are not going to get the research that we need and to have the knowledge that we need if we do not recognize that, and if we do not really articulate a whole research agenda that will give us the information that we need to really analyze this. There's nothing wrong with being nostalgic. I'm like everybody else. Mm-hmm. I love A Starry Sky. But I think that light pollution is also what the eyes sees. We don't see airborne pollution unless it's lit by light pollution. Mm-hmm. So I've said, somewhat provocatively sometimes that I am more in favor of light pollution because of what it actually does. We don't see waterborne pollution. It doesn't mean that it's not there and doesn't harm mm-hmm. people. And again, in terms of comparatively, how bad is light pollution on... how bad is the impact of light pollution on the global environmental and ecosystems?
Well, nobody can answer that question. Yeah, nobody can answer that question because it's the field is so fragmented into different areas. The darkness restoration and night preservation space. I don't even like you're a person of terms. I don't like the term dark sky. It's very difficult to translate into other languages. Doesn't make sense in some languages to say dark sky to translate that. It doesn't have a call to action in it. And you actually want bright skies filled with stars. Like you don't actually want dark skies. Dark skies are bad. You want lots of stars in the sky. So the terminology, the way we talk about it, the average person in the public and most of the people in the environmental movement, other environmental movements, would see light pollution as a metaphor that it's not really pollution. It's just we're using pollution as a metaphor to describe excess light at night. And that, I think that's totally wrong. I think light pollution is 100% sorry, my lights just went off here and on again, folks. light pollution is pollution. And it causes all matter. And it's got to the point where it's grotesque now, Natalie. I think a lot of people, including myself, look at light pollution as, gone from, I made a point there, went from conspicuous to grotesque. Like light pollution is disgusting now. When it's going into the ocean 2 miles out, deep into the water, it's in people's car lights and street lights. It's absolutely awful, but there isn't really a, sort of a hub. Well, Karolina Zielinska-Dabkowska is working on sort of or has finished a, literature review of all of the current literature on light pollution and what it says. But even then, who's the leader in that field, Natalie? Who's in charge of that? Is it Dark Sky International or is it, who's in charge? Who's the leader? Is there any government organizations, that are interested in it? It's tough to find.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm saying is we have to be, I don't think that there's such a thing as all the literature right now because they are, there are so many ways to find information. I'll just give you one example. A couple of years ago, just because it's really a topic that I'd like to use for Scope as a platform to discuss. I think we need more of those discussions. We've seen countless reports or comments on, I'm going to sound awfully cynical, but the little turtles that die. And it seems to be zillions of turtles, according to those reports, that will die. And basically, it's all because of light pollution. Well, one year, we had an intern, and I decided to just dig into this. So we actually counted turtles. We looked at the global turtle population that hatches at night, which is not the majority of turtles. And then we looked at the percentage of the turtle populations in Florida, where, if I'm not mistaken, I think 90% of the U.S. Night hatching turtles are located, and Australia, which is also very aggressive in terms of turtle-friendly lighting devices. So that came down to 17%. Those two areas that host, the vast majority of the turtles is 17% of the global night hatching turtle populations. When you look, I'm not saying that, and then you can also find out that the main prime cause of death is dune reconstruction. I think I remember that fishing nets is second, and light at night and disorientation comes at least third, if not further down. And then you look at, well, why is there lighting? Very often it's because there's new development. So lighting is actually attached to, it's circumstantial. It's maybe the development is what we should question, not the lighting. And just like energy efficiency, we seem to be very willing to be the culprit here, just because light is what the eye sees.
I understand what you're saying. By stepping back from the issue and looking at the light pollution from a perspective of how did it get there in the first place, and then measuring, what has a greater impact on turtles, dune reconstruction or light pollution. It's an interesting way. What are some other social and critical issues that are important to you?
Well, one project that I've been working on for a few years and has been picking up in the past year or so is dermatophotology. So dermatophotology is, again, I use the words, for Scopes Lexicon all the time. So photology was not invented by Foscope. Photology is actually the science of light, and dermatophotology is the science of light and skin. I started that project because I have a friend who is a beautiful singer, and she was one time performing in a fairly dark restaurant, and she's dark skinned, and so was her musician, and you basically couldn't see them. So as a good, I can't remember if I was a photo tech already. I think I was. I decided I'm going to create a little light fixture that she can put in her purse and hook up wherever she goes. I like to play with, miniature of creatures, so I pretty much already had some accessories. And the question was, what should be the spectral distribution? So I go in and I believe a lot of people would have gone. Actually, a lot of people have done from based on what I've heard. I tried different filters with my little, portable light, and I started with amber. And amber did not look good on Vienna. So I tried a few more filters, and then I did, suddenly lavender was, oh, her skin was coming alive. And that really took me by surprise. And I thought, well, we go with amber, straw. That's our default. That's what even my generation, we were not formally trained lighting designers, but through practice, that's pretty much what we know. And I thought there was something there that I had never heard. And then I started looking it up, and turns out that photographers who photograph people of colors are giving those kind of some resources. With those kind of tips, lavender, blues, pink, for skin of color. And I realized, well, has our industry actually ever looked at spectral distribution or, I always prefer the chromaticity approach than color temperature, but have we ever thought of this and controlled it for skin tone? And it's very clear that we haven't. And when you expand that research, again, put this in context, in a wider context, in theatrical lighting, there's been an acknowledgement that you really had to change your palette when you were lighting different skin tones. Cinematography has also done some progress, because the whole history of film technology was based on fair tone standards. So when you start looking at it, it's not necessarily an intentional bias, but there is a long history of bias that's built in technology. And I thought that, well, we need to look at this in architectural lighting as well. So that was, so I started this about 5 years ago, and then my friend started performing online, in 2020. And clearly there was, so we did some more tests and I worked with her a little more. But other things happened in the US in 2020 that led to a greater interest in that line of inquiry. And I have to say that in the past year or so, there's definitely been much more interest. So now we're actually talking with and meeting with the IES that has several technical committees, Committee on Color, because, for instance, they recognized the TM30 had not looked at skin tone. And then there's video conferencing, and we are looking for industry partners so that we can really do some experiments and, psychophysical studies to really get a sense of how big is the problem, first of all?
I was going to say, is it even a problem? Like, that would be my question. So the assertion here, and just correct me if I'm wrong, the assertion here is that architectural lighting, film, cinematic lighting, and theater lighting have been created in a manner to prefer the skin of Caucasians rather than people of other ethnicities?
By default, yeah.
But like,
just because nobody thought that Caucasian skin was not the standard.
Well,
nobody
thought
about
nobody said, yeah, let's gear it to white people's skin so we can exclude other. And so why is this a problem?
Well, ask people who have darker skin tones than the three of us. They'll tell you.
But what would they say? Like, I don't know what the... See, like, when I go to a theater, I see the theater lighting, and it shines on people equally. And what the assertion here is that it is very slightly tuned to favor Caucasian people, and it should be tuned back or changed to reflect other... I don't see this as really a problem. I don't know. I don't understand how it's like, how it causes trouble. Like, I see some of the other things, but next time you do a lighting system, you consider what race the people are going to be under it and tune it accordingly. Is that the idea? Like, what's the solution to the problem?
Okay, so at the risk of being provocative, I do not use the word race, because it's been proven to be a completely false framework. The history of pigmentation, the evolution of pigmentation, is actually pretty well established by biologists today. It's all about protection against UV, against cell degeneration, and the entrainment of the vitamin D production. So you can map it, and of course, populations have moved across the globe. So now you have the mix that you have. I'm not saying that. Theater is different. So let's go. I'll start with theater and cinematography. You light a subject. A lot of us did not like and do not like the way they look in with conventional light sources. Again, there's been major progress in those fields, because people have really experimented and found better, more flattering spectral distribution, but also it's not just the spectral distribution, it's also the light distribution. You know, you have issues of specularity, you have you create contrasts in different ways depending on the level of the intensity of the pigmentation of the skin. So you have it's like a, you know, a tool, a kit that you learn, and once you know that, you can really use it and apply it to different people. When it comes to architectural lighting, people are not the subject of architectural lighting. Mm-hmm. Usually the environment is. Mm-hmm. However, I am, just to give you an example, I'm in a conference room, there's general lighting. I'm on a screen, you're looking at me, it's going to be streamed on a website. If my skin tone were different, and I don't know what I'm going to look like, but if my skin tone were different, I might find that I look very green and yellow on your website, and it might upset me, and possibly rightfully so, just because in the light sources that I have in this room, that light source works best for our kind of skin tone. Mm. So I think it's worth looking into. To answer your question, I don't know how big the problem is. I don't know how easy the solution is, but I think it's worth acknowledging that it's something that we never thought. And in itself, that's possibly...
I think that's part of what you're doing is, what you're doing is questioning and seeing if some of these questions can take root at a deeper level and expand themselves into research in different areas and into the practice. And whether or not that happens to any given extent is not really the point. Am I correct on that, Natalie?
Yeah.
Hmm. Hmm. That's super interesting.
Yeah, like and I think I was going to say, I think that's what's needed right now in lighting because of where things are at, and I agree with questioning everything, but then my question is always, how is it ever going to get a result, and how is it going to happen? It's only people like you that do the research and spend the time and the money. Why isn't anybody else doing this kind of thing in lighting? Who's leading this?
Well, and that's why we are doing it, that's why we are doing it with the IES. I mean, I have always, every time I speak about this project, and I speak about it every chance I get, I think it's shared knowledge that we need. And, you know, it's important to do this together. So I'm really happy that the IES is interested in working with us. I'd love to find industry partners. We definitely need industry partners to push this further. But our industry is, I go back to our industry is very practice, very practice driven and product driven and technology driven. So we need those kind of, topics as well, greater topics to bring another level of knowledge and that can really drive our practice. And I think that will really, help us, all of our field and the recognition for our field.
Mm. One other question just on the Light Reach Network. You want to just touch on that quick, what that's all about?
Sure. You want me to explain where it came from or how it...
Yeah, just a summary of what it is and what you do there.
Yeah. So I began Light Reach because I had worked as a volunteer with the French nonprofit Concept de Lumière Sans Frontières, which is Lighting Designers Without Borders. And when I volunteered, they had a project in Haiti. And coincidentally, the year I went, the client, which was a local nonprofit, asked us to look at an electrification project that they had for informal settlements. So, and that was, about around 2013, I think. when I got into lighting, I go back to the idea that I felt there were so many opportunities for things to look at. Back in 2000, there were a lot of urban planners, sociologists who were looking at informal settlements and analyzing the habitat and the economy and the ecologies of urban settlements. Nobody was looking at it in terms of lighting. So I started doing some of that research and looking at theoretical lighting solutions. My interest in solar powered lighting goes way back. So by the time I was in Haiti with that question, I pretty much had a a turnkey solution for what I thought those environments needed. And I basically convinced them that, I mean, they had a electrification project going on, but given the complicated state of infrastructure in Haiti, to put it simply, I argued that with solar powered lighting, we could act really fast and at really low cost. So in the long term, they could go with a wired solution, but in the meantime, we could give them lighting very, very fast. So I developed, I applied basically a model that I had been chewing on for a while, and that was a very replicable model. So based on that, I launched LightReach, which is very much, it's a global initiative that uses program-based, and the programs are multiple projects that are all based on the same template. There's a turnkey template. There's a model to work with local partners. I mean, everything I've learned along the way, everything that works, how to actually do this, is in LightReach. So we did a pilot program in Puerto Rico with three pilot projects. We were going to continue in 2020, but we had some fundraisers listed, and we were going to do at least three more projects, but that stopped abruptly. And however, in 2020, we began working in Lebanon. We had to modify the model somehow because of, we couldn't send volunteers to work with communities, and the program leader over there was, had to do a lot of that alone and with volunteers. We couldn't also do any training, workshops. Education is a big part of all of that. I'm very keen on education. If I may just add as a parenthesis that another thing that FOSCOP does is I do not agree with the make lighting simple, simplify the language approach to all. I think that this of light is not rocket science. I've taught, spectrum to, again, populations of varying ages and levels of education in Haiti, and people understand pretty quickly why certain spectral distribution is good, because they work at night, they do their crafts at night so that they can sell during the day. People understand those things really quickly, and I think that we'd be better off to push for more science education at a younger age rather than oversimplifying how we speak about light. I think we'd be much better off. But anyway, so that's where we are. We are talking about now launching a program in Turkey. Where we work is where there has been a natural human-made disaster. We are not, LightReach is not an emergency program. We basically bring light to communities to support their social and cultural lives. I find that it's, so for instance, in Lebanon, it's a bit hard to get information now, but we know that there's going to be container towns. In all those places, anything informal is supposed to be temporary, but very often, especially in corrupt, in countries.
So people
where
are going to live in containers in Lebanon. That's what's going to happen after this port blast and the inflation and all this stuff.
No, in Turkey. In Turkey, after the earthquake, they're probably already some container towns. That's what happens. And those solutions are supposed to be temporary. Government will, you know, NGOs will put people in containers until there's some reconstruction effort. Problem is, those solutions tend to last. And I think that with light, by lighting exterior spaces, you can really support people's social life and cultural life. I mean, in Puerto Rico, the pilot program was called Recreo de Noche, playing at night, because the vision was if you light a playground, the kids are going to go and play. I mean, all those countries, you know, have in common that it's dark fairly early, late afternoon, 6 or 7. So if you light a playground, the kids are going to go and play, the parents are going to go and hang out. So it becomes a multi-generational space. And if you give people the tools to transform that space because there is some kind of festival or there is some kind of celebration, and you teach people how to manipulate and how to create accessories for the lighting that you bring, then you really empower people to have a quality exterior space. It's, you know, we do, I mean, one of the things that I'm most proud of, I think, with LightReach is that we actually do landscape architectural lighting with utility lights that are made for, you know, people to put on top of a barn door. But we bring a design expertise and we share that design expertise with people. We empower them with that. So then it's a great, and I think it's a great plus at the low cost. You know, the return on investment, I go back to that, is really quite high.
And, you know, one of the things that I looked at before you came on and then I've been going through over the course of the show is the FOSS words. Is that how you would pronounce it? It's like a dictionary of new or, I guess, maybe different design terminology to describe how light interacts with old age, for example. So you have geriatric on the website there, and that's your discuss. I love that. I think that a whole set of terminology based on that is wonderful. Natalie, do we have any final thoughts for the Get a Grip on Lighting listeners from your perspective before we close the show?
Final thoughts. I think that they should be more phototexts. And I'm just going to, you know, pledge for the industry to be more supportive of what Foscope is trying to do, really, because I'm keen on the collective dimension of seeking more knowledge and new knowledge. And I really hope to inspire, you know, people in the industry and every size of the industry to work with us and to bring new projects that we can work on. So,
well, it worked today. I'm inspired by you. I'm pretty sure Greg is too. But you know what else is really inspiring, Greg? Aerial cable from GripBlockSystems.com, buddy. Come on, man.
That's one thing you shouldn't question. I know we said question everything. That one you don't, because it's way better than chain. I'm speaking from experience. Mm-hmm. Use the grip lock stuff. It's easy to adjust. You can move it up and down. Saves you a ton of money and labor. Good product. You need it.
Go to GripBlockSystems.com. I know I spelled it wrong in the introduction, but we're going to, I'll go for it. Grip, G-R-I-P, lock, L-O-C-K. Systems, SYSTEMS.com. Greg Garrick, I did it. And of course, that's the right. National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors. That's right. We're members. You got a warehouse with lights in it? Why don't you join us? Start making moves with us. And we're getting together It's next week. I don't know if that's whatever that is when this goes out, but that's the 17th to the 20th, Greg. Is that what it is? 17th to 19th, Dallas,
yeah,
Texas?
Yeah, right there. Yep. Yes.
And of course, Natalie Rozot, thank you for coming on the show. And we will post all of her websites, Foscope, Lightreach, and her social media to the Get a Grip on Lighting website. So if you want to follow her, go to getagriponlighting.com and check it out. Thank you for listening. Bye for now.